Hello, I'm Steve Evans. Welcome to the Business Daily podcast with a very good definition of a tax haven.
Sunny places for shady people. We want the sun to shine, not just on non-shady people, but also on shady people.
But Bermuda's finance minister says, not us, my friend.
We're not in any way representing anything that is improper. So no trickery. Bermuda doesn't need to resort to tricks.
Plus, should you kill your granny when times get tough?
You could draw straws, but this is actually the most economically efficient course of action.
The logic of economics in your Business Daily download from the BBC. The phrase is that tax havens are sunny places for shady characters, and whatever the truth of that rather neat maxim, it's clear that the heat on them has been turned up of late. After the bailouts came the bills, and finance ministers are hunting for every single penny of revenue, including in faraway places that previously sheltered corporate profits from the inconvenience of taxation back home. And sometimes not so far from home, you know. President Obama looked a mere 600 miles east of the US and rounded on Bermuda, following which Bermuda changed its law. It also agreed to take four Guantanamo prisoners into the bargain. Not that there was a bargain, the country insists. So the Caribbean paradise for sunseekers and for tax avoiders is much changed, according to the country's finance minister, Paula Cox, who's been making that very pitch in the City of London.
We are here to tell the Bermuda story, let people know what Bermuda business and doing business in Bermuda means, the services we offer, and basically to whet their appetite for Bermuda.
Why? Because the OECD and President Obama wants some of the money which currently resides in your territory.
I don't think so. I think that they want to get to those jurisdictions that are not seen as clean. Unlike other jurisdictions, Bermuda has not only met the OECD standard, but we've exceeded it. We have 19 tax information exchange agreements. We certainly have been commended by IRS Treasury for doing work to help them in terms of dealing with some of the issues of tax with some of the U.S. citizens. And I think Bermuda is seen really as a cooperative jurisdiction. So I think we're one who U.S. business and U.K. business is, and U.K. governments are happy to see have business.
Except that companies are leaving or talking of leaving. We think of Tyco, you think of Accenture, you think of Willis, the big insurance group.
If you were to ask me, would I prefer that they not leave? Clearly. But at the same time, I appreciate that while they leave and set up somewhere, they also retain the presence and the jobs in Bermuda. And that is most important, particularly for me as a Minister of Finance.
Explain what you mean, though. The implication being that companies leave but don't leave.
Well, what we have in Bermuda, you have the ability to incorporate, let's say you incorporate in another island and you have a permit to do business in Bermuda. So there, some of the companies don't actually incorporate in Bermuda. They may incorporate in another jurisdiction, but their substance is in Bermuda. Now, in a couple of the high profile, I don't include Tyco in that list, but in a couple of the insurance companies where they may move and set up an office or headquarters in another jurisdiction, what you find is that they still retain a holding company in Bermuda, and where that's where you still have jobs and real presence, and you have a branch in Bermuda. So in terms of from the Bermuda revenue point of view, and in terms of the labor market, you still have substance there.
That sounds, forgive me, but that sounds like a bit of trickery to me. In other words, what you seem to be saying is that with the crackdown by Obama, the verbal crackdown anyway, by Obama and the OECD, companies are moving a bit of their operations, but not much. There's a bit of a flight of companies for some purposes away from Bermuda, but the business stays there.
No, I think if there's trickery, I think you probably want to look to the jurisdictions where they move. I think Bermuda, we've always had the permit, and they continue to have the permit to do business in Bermuda. So it's nothing at all that's being subverted on the Bermuda end. I think that what you have is that you have treaties that they may have with other jurisdictions in terms of, say, whether it's EU and the US, but I don't think, certainly from our point of view, you have a permit to do business in Bermuda, and it's a clear, established company law, and it's certainly something which is seen as reputable and credible. We're not in any way representing in any ways anything that is improper. I think what you may wish to look at is the nature of the treaty relationship, which means that in some ways, because of the treaty benefit of being headquartered somewhere in the UK or the EU, you get benefits. But Bermuda has marketed itself. It is quite clear and transparent as to the position. So no trickery. Bermuda doesn't need to resort to tricks. We have reputation, we have credibility, and we have long-standing cooperative relationships with both within the UK and with the US.
I was wondering whether, if companies are now moving their operations or bits of their operations...
Headquarters. I think what you would say, probably the more correct legal position would be that if companies are headquartering in other jurisdictions, and if their international relations are such that they have treaties, and treaties are between both countries, that's certainly transparent and reputable. And if the treaty, the nature of the treaty relationship is such that they gain benefits, then I don't think you can fault them or call them tricksters for doing that, because treaties aren't something which is any hole in the corner affair. There's something between policymakers from both jurisdictions negotiate. But I'm not here to be the apologist for other jurisdictions. I'm here to tell you the Bermuda story and that we are here to do business and to welcome business.
When you agreed to take four people from Guantanamo, what did you get for that from Obama?
I didn't agree, but I certainly am not aware that the Bermuda government benefited in any substantial way apart from showing comity of nations and a certain amount of recognition of humanitarian reasons.
How are they getting on there?
It would seem fine, but I certainly have no personal knowledge.
That was Paula Cox, the Finance Minister of Bermuda. Now, the Organisation for Cooperation and Development identifies three factors that make a tax haven. One, very low taxes on profits from outside. Two, no scrutiny by outside tax authorities. And three, a lack of transparency about the way the tax law works. After the G20 summits in Washington, London and Pittsburgh 2 years ago, the OECD started putting pressure on the obvious tax havens to reform. Some have now complied, though it should be said that there's always an appetite for low-tax countries. Ghana, for example, is trying to set itself up as a low-tax centre in West Africa. Jeffrey Owens, head of tax at the OECD, told me what the known long-standing tax havens now had to do.
The first thing that they have to do is to endorse the standards of transparency and effective exchange of information, cooperation between tax authorities. And then the second thing, having endorsed those standards, they have to go and implement them. What that means in practice is putting in place agreements and having those agreements implemented in a consistent fashion.
And I imagine transparency is absolutely crucial to this, so that people can examine the accounts of companies which are registered, incorporated in an area.
That's correct, yes. I mean, it's particularly important in the Caribbean. There are many Caribbean islands that have thousands and thousands of shell companies. We want to know who lies behind these share companies. Or if you have bearer shares, we want to know who lies behind the bearer shares.
What's the crucial distinction then between a tax haven and a country which simply has a very generous tax regime?
We have no problems with countries that decide they're not going to have any income tax systems, or they're going to have low rates of tax, or they're going to have in place generous tax regimes. What we are concerned about is that a country doesn't hold itself out as a place where the residents of other countries can escape tax. That, if you like, has always been the traditional definition of a tax haven, yeah? A place that facilitates tax evasion. Or, you know, you can go back and you may remember Somerset Maugham. I mean, he defined a tax haven as sort of sunny places for shady people. That's what it's all about. You know, we want the sun to shine not just on non-shady people, but also on shady people.
If Bermuda is coming on board, if it's making you happier, which are the countries, the archipelagos, whatever, which aren't?
You know, if you'd asked me this question 6 months ago, I could have rattled off a whole range of names. Today, it's very hard because the 91 countries that are now engaged in this process, all of them are committed to the process, all of them are negotiating. Fine, there are still some that have not yet got past this magic number, the 12 threshold that we're looking for in terms of agreements, countries like Panama. But frankly, today, there's very, very significant progress being made. The next step in this exercise now is what we call the peer reviews, where we will be looking in depth at all 91 countries to see how far are they in practice implementing these standards. And that's when the rubber's going to hit the road.
Ghana is looking at, how can one put it politely, a benign tax regime in West Africa. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, we've been in a dialogue with Ghana. I mean, I think, you know, Ghana, like any other country, has the right to establish a financial center. But what we're saying to our colleagues in Ghana is, if you're going to do that, make sure that you're on the right side of the line. Make sure that, in fact, the financial center meets and applies the highest standards of integrity. And that, I think, is a message that's getting through to the Ghanaians, that there's a dialogue going on, and there's nothing wrong in them establishing a financial center. But that financial center should not turn into an African tax haven.
So if Ghana is setting up a tax regime where companies pay less tax in Accra than they do in neighbouring capitals, that's okay, but not if they do it secretly so that deceit can take place on the part of the companies registering there.
Clearly, yes, that's something that we want to avoid. If a company or an individual is trying to use Ghana to evade taxes back home, that's not acceptable.
And when you say transfer profits out, you mean somehow those profits, global profits, or even West African profits, end up being taken in Ghana because of its low tax rates. That would not be proper.
It depends. I mean, if the company has respected the OECD guidelines on transfer pricing, yes, the prices that you charge for related transactions within a multinational.
Accurate prices, as it were.
Accurate or market-based prices, that's fine. If a company tries to manipulate those prices to shift profits out of a high-tax jurisdiction into a low-tax jurisdiction, that's not acceptable. And that is something that we are now focusing on quite a lot.
So in Ghana, you keep your eye on the situation.
Ghana, in fact, we've invited them to join the Global Forum to become part of this worldwide partnership. And I am very confident, in fact, that they're going to accept that offer and will, in fact, be prepared to undergo a peer review.
So be warned. Geoffrey Owens, the head of tax at the OECD. Our email address is world.business@bbc.co.uk. You're listening to Business Daily from the BBC with Steve Evans. Now, there are many ways to catch a thief. Obviously, red-handed is best, but there are all sorts of other ways, like parking tickets. If you want an index of how corrupt a country is, for example, a good indicator is how likely its diplomats are to break parking law around the United Nations in New York. Clean countries have clean parkers. It's one example of a telltale sign of something else going on, identified by Raymond Fisman of Columbia University Business School, who's written a book called Economic Gangsters. But first, where do the diplomats fit in?
By virtue of their diplomatic immunity, they can park with impunity. They can double park on crosstown Manhattan streets. And unlike other New Yorkers, they get away with it. And the main finding there is that countries that have reputations for cultures, if you like, of corruption, countries like Chad and Somalia rack up large numbers of parking violations per diplomat, whereas countries that have squeaky clean reputations, like, say, Norway and Sweden, actually never accumulated a single unpaid violation.
And things like droughts and witch killings. What's going on there?
We try to focus on the economic motivations that underlie what often seem like irrational and chaotic situations. And in one chapter of the book, we look at the case of witch killing in Tanzania, which at the heart of it, we argue, is an economic phenomenon, that people are labeled and persecuted as witches not because of some anachronistic set of beliefs, but rather an economic imperative to reduce family sizes in times of drought. And that is, for example, why elderly women are traditionally targeted, because they are the greatest consumers of resources relative to the production of resources they provide.
Surely it can't be that families say, hold on a minute, times are hard. The dear old lady in the corner is eating too much and doesn't produce very much, therefore let's call her a witch and kill her. That's not it, is it?
That's exactly what we have in mind. And this is not casting aspersions on these communities.
Sounds like a pretty fierce nasturtium is being cast to me.
Well, it's a pretty brutal calculus that they face, and that none of us, certainly not you or I, ever are faced with, in that there's simply not enough food to go around. So if everyone in the family cut back, then everyone would likely perish. You could draw straws, but this is actually the most economically efficient course of action. Now, you can't target your grandmother, as you say, in this way, and get to sleep at night without some rationalization. So where psychology comes in, perhaps, is you generate a set of beliefs that somehow rationalizes this to yourself.
This is all fascinating, but I wonder if it's any use, and if it is, how we might make the world better by using your knowledge.
Well, in the case of witch killing, it presents an obvious set of interventions, which is that first and foremost, you'd like to iron out the fluctuations in incomes in these poor communities. Rather than focus solely on investment for building incomes in the long term, you really want to emphasize insuring these communities against negative income shocks due to the weather or commodity prices. And that's one of the solutions that we present in the book. It also suggests that you might want to target these programs at the most vulnerable populations. One curious example is witch killing evaporated in South Africa when elderly people were given generous pensions. You wouldn't want to kill the golden goose, the goose that lays the golden eggs, so to speak.
Well, absolutely. It's getting to be the most cynical interview I've ever done, but you know, I don't doubt the truth of it. What about things like, I mean, out-and-out corruption? What can be done there? What are the economic disincentives and incentives that could be altered?
A society that pays bribes and takes bribes is in some sense in equilibrium. We have consistent beliefs between the driver that is offering the bribe and the policeman who is accepting it. And it's very hard to shift these systems. So one case that we discuss in some detail is the reform of Bogota, where there was really this emphasis on changing as a group when Antanas Mockus came into office as mayor. And one of his first acts as mayor was to hire mimes to police the streets. And what they did was simply mock people who broke the law. Now, the genius in this is that it very publicly signals to everyone in the city that the equilibrium is shifting. We're moving towards a system of legal compliance. It's also genius in the sense that it's bribe-proof. No one tried to pay off the mimes to stop mocking them. Okay. This then became a matter of community participation. They handed out cards, much like a referee wields in a football game, where you could flash a thumbs up or a thumbs down if you saw someone do something good or a positive civic act or a negative one. And this, again, allowed people to see that the equilibrium was shifting. Everyone was participating in this civic reform. It is, I think, possibly the greatest anti-corruption success story in modern history.
Raymond Fisman, warning perhaps that if you're a grandmother, you might pray for rain, and prompting emails to world.business@bbc.co.uk.